Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. So this weekend, I was reorganizing my house. I do this pretty much every weekend. And I realized at one point that what I needed was like two of those outlets that can turn your two-prong outlet into eight. You can plug in eight things. And I also needed hooks, lots of hooks to organize my house. Did I go to my local hardware store, which I love going to? No. Did I even go to our local big box store? No, I did not. I, of course, ordered them from Amazon. They're arriving tonight. I use my Gmail account, run by Google, to complete the order. And when I get those hooks and I've got my house finally organized beautifully, I'll take a picture on Instagram, owned by Facebook. Am I part of the problem here? I think I am. Amazon doesn't just get me outlets. They just announced recently a new healthcare company, together with Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan. Today we're talking about how big is too big. Are companies like Amazon and Google monopolies that threaten our future? My guests today are Lena Khan. She's director of legal policy at Open Markets Institute, and Alex Shepard, a staff writer at The New Republic. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Hi.
If you have a question about monopolies and especially the size of modern tech businesses like Google and Amazon, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Lena, why don't I start with you? That healthcare company that was just announced is pretty breathtaking, but not necessarily monopolistic. What does it take to be a monopoly and not just a behemoth in our modern world?
So the traditional definition of a monopoly is a company that has the power to set prices and to squash competition. That was traditionally how we understood monopoly, and we really used to understand monopolies as not just a threat to our markets, but also as a threat to our democracy. So there was also a sense that businesses that amass a lot of economic power are able to wield that in abusive ways, such that that has consequences for our democracy and for our markets. Over the years, the definition of monopoly has become more technical, so the law now applies a series of technical tests to try and assess, you know, whether a company has the necessary power in the market to keep competitors out and hike prices. And the primary metric that we now look at is whether the company can hike prices or limit output. And so that's really what we look at when we try to understand whether a company has become monopolistic by the traditional, by the new current legal term.
Okay, so help me out here, because I'm not sure who runs these tests. Is there somebody in Washington, D.C. constantly running these tests and then gets a bingo? Amazon is now a monopoly and then they get broken up?
It's a good question. So the inquiry really only usually comes up in the context of a lawsuit. So, you know, if there are private parties that are bringing a case against Amazon, an antitrust case, then they'll have to show that, you know, the company has monopoly power. Similarly, if the Justice Department or state attorneys generals are, you know, examining whether the company is abusing its power, they will also have to analyze whether it has become a monopoly. Oftentimes, you know, the market share that a company enjoys in particular sectors, that can help us infer about monopoly power. So, you know, Amazon in certain segments enjoys upwards of 60, 70, 80% of a line of business. I think that would weigh strongly in favor of thinking that it is monopolistic. It is a monopoly in those lines of business, such as in ebooks.
Alex, welcome. Hi.
Hi.
So
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that Amazon in particular is a monopoly?
Well, I think that they have certainly amassed economic power that is unsettling in various sectors of the economy. You know, if you talk to people at Amazon or some of their defenders, the number that they'll harp is that, you know, e-commerce only constitutes something like 8 or 9% of all commercial transactions. However, like if you talk to people who invest in companies that do things like e-commerce, those people stopped investing in startups, you know, that could compete with Amazon years ago, because there's just a sense that any competing company has no chance, that Amazon will just squash them like a bug. Not even that they'll acquire them, that they'll just be run out. And if you look at other things, particularly in the publishing industry, which I think is in some ways the canary in the coal mine here, you know, their ebook share has, you know, right after the Kindle was introduced, was upwards of 90%. It's probably stabilized somewhere between 60 and 70%. But, you know, there are occasionally little breaths of life from competitors. Like Walmart just announced a partnership with a Canadian ebook company. But none of those things are really happening in America. And what Amazon has done consistently is it's squeezed publishers for lower prices. And, you know, you see that in Literary Outpost, you know, which I think has been really damaged over the last 20 years.
So is Amazon's monopoly on in publishing or e-commerce, what exactly do they in particular have a monopoly on?
Well, in the case of, I think, you know, the ebook case is particularly instructive, which is that they, you know, essentially control the distribution of ebooks, right? And in terms of print books, they have an increasing share partly because of the slow decline of large competitors like Barnes & Noble. And the result in these cases has been that because they control these channels, basically publishers have continually been merging to try to create large enough companies that could somehow compete with Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. So you had Penguin and Random House that merged, I think, in 2011. And of course, they can't even come close. And what ends up happening is that Amazon essentially is dictating sales terms. And, you know, publishers need to sell their books on Amazon, because if they don't sell their books on Amazon, they're going to lose, you know, 50, 60% of sales in some cases. And, you know, with ebooks, you know, having, depending on who you talk to, stabilized around 30% of publishers' transactions, that's a huge economic incentive. And Amazon has shown over the last 20 years that they'll use that weight to get what they want.
We're talking about monopolies, modern monopolies. Give us your call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Tyler in Alexandria has called with a question. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My biggest concern is these companies amassing tons of patents and using those to fend off smaller companies and crush them before they even have a chance to innovate. And, you know, the patent laws have not seemed to have evolved as the tech industry has. Any thoughts or insights on that?
Lena, how about you? Do you think that the patent laws are making it hard for people to compete with new tech, with these tech behemoths?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, Amazon very famously patented the one-click, you know, button to make sure that it has an edge in online shopping. You know, even at that microscopic level, which ended up, I think, you know, actually causing problems for competitors who tried to introduce similar technologies, so that, you know, you could just press one button to add things to your cart and end up at the checkout page. I think more generally we've seen Amazon act aggressively with patents and, you know, collect a hoard of patents that make it difficult for competitors to compete on a level playing field. You know, patents are important. They serve an important function. They ensure that companies are able to take risks with the guarantee that if those risks are lucrative, that they'll be able to cash in on that for a certain amount of point. But after a while, hoarding patents also becomes abusive. And there have actually been cases throughout American history where the government has come in and acknowledged that companies have acquired too much control over patents and required that those companies kind of open up their patent vaults and share their technologies with other companies. And this often happens when we recognize companies as having, you know, developed technologies that are now so essential to the economy, to marketplaces, that we say other companies also need to have access. So, you know, I think there is a precedent for the government ensuring that the control over patents is not being abused. And I think that's something that we need to be thinking about in the context of Amazon, but also in the context of Google and some of the other tech giants.
Alex, the one-click patent expired in September. Has Amazon, do you think Amazon is under threat now of other companies rising up because they can now do the one-click ordering too?
I mean, I'm, as it's probably pretty clear, like, remarkably cynical about these things. And my take is probably that it doesn't matter one way or the other, because there's just nothing, you know, even though you could say companies like Walmart have invested really heavily in making their online interface much more customer friendly, I just don't think it matters because, you know, Amazon right now, something like 54% of American households have Prime and 53% go to church every Sunday. I think that tells you something about how powerful they are.
Do you think that innovation is being quashed in the United States because of these behemoths? In my house, it feels like these companies are helping foster innovation. I've got both a Google Home Mini and an Amazon Alexa, and then there are companies that are using Alexa to reach me in new ways. Heck, I mean, I've got to say it's pretty good for public radio to have that stuff. And it seems like they are fostering new things in driverless cars. And don't they help innovate in some ways, Lena?
I think the key question when you're thinking about innovation is how easy is it for somebody with an idea to bring that idea to market? And, you know, in a traditional marketplace, when you have lots of buyers, lots of sellers, when you have, you know, a bunch of intermediaries, it shouldn't be too hard. If you have a good idea and you go to one entity and, you know, they reject you, you have another option. I think the concern in the context of Amazon is that it has wrapped up control. It is kind of the railroad of the 21st century. And so if you have a product or an idea that you want to bring to market, you have to ride its rails. And that gives it enormous power and is able to abuse that power. When people are introducing goods or products that it thinks threaten its own lines of business, it can reject them. It can demote them on its search listings. It has, you know, enormous control over whether entrepreneurs, whether independent businesses are able to reach consumers. And I say that is bad for innovation.
Alex, do you think that they help foster innovation or that they quash it?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer, largely because these companies, I mean, this is going to sound kind of evasive, but they also have kind of taken over a monopolistic control of innovation and have sold themselves as being, you know, the key innovators of our economy. They're pushing us forward, you know, into the 21st century. And I think that is the sort of key to their political and consumer selling points, right, that this isn't your sort of old-fashioned, retail. This is the key to the future, right? But because they have amassed so much power in these sectors, you know, I think it's unsettling to me, you know, even that just five or six companies are where we're getting all of these innovations.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. We're talking about modern monopolies and whether big giant companies like these platform companies such as Amazon and Google are the new Standard Oil and, you know, frankly, whether they should be busted up. Give us a call if you have a question about these modern monopolies or a worry about them or a story about them. And I'd love to hear from somebody who's an entrepreneur who has had to work with Amazon, too. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. My guests are Lena Kahn. She's Director of Legal Policy at the Open Markets Institute. She's in Dallas, Texas. And Alex Shepard. He's a staff writer at the New Republic in New York City. Lena, one, you know, a traditional litmus test for whether monopoly is needs to be broken up is whether it's bad for the consumer. And it feels like these are all pretty good for consumers. It's good for us right now, and then in 10 years, we'll look around and think, what did we do? Where are all the stores, and how come Amazon is controlling my entire home? Do you think that that should be the litmus test of whether it's good or bad for the consumers?
So that's the litmus test that is primarily used now. Antitrust laws are primarily interpreted under what's known as the consumer welfare standard. And under that, you really look at, you know, is the company raising prices? That is a anomaly. For the vast majority of our history, we actually used antitrust laws in a much broader way to understand whether a company was abusing powers against workers, against entrepreneurs, whether it was closing off markets to newcomers. And so we really used a host of measures to try and understand whether a company had powers in ways that were, excessive powers in ways that the antitrust laws should adopt. I think Amazon offers a particularly elegant example of the shortcomings of this consumer welfare regime, because it shows how a business that has built its, you know, strategy and rhetoric around lowering prices for consumers can effectively disable the antitrust laws if the only thing they're going to be focused on is consumer prices. So I think we see this tension, you know, come to the surface, especially in the context of Amazon, but it's also something that you hear, you know, in the context of Google, where people will say, oh, well, you know, Google's offering so many of its products for free, and, you know, there aren't any real entry barriers because competition is one click away, and so there are no problems here. And I think that shows a really anachronistic way of understanding what the, you know, what's important in these markets when we're thinking about market power. And I think it also is divorced from the realities of how market power gets used in these markets. You know, as Alex said, look at how Wall Street is reacting to these companies and look at how Wall Street is, you know, investing or not investing. I think that, you know, in some ways, Wall Street is more able to grapple with these issues than our current legal regime is.
When did we change? I mean, Standard Oil, like, so the Sherman Antitrust Act is from, what, 1890? And Standard Oil was broken up in the early 1900s. When did we change from to looking at whether it's just good or bad for the consumer's wallet, Lena?
So interestingly, there was no change in actual law. You know, the antitrust laws were passed in 1890 and 1914. And initially, you know, there was some variation in how we interpreted them. We had a period where we were using them to bust up labor and realized that was a mistake. But generally, for the vast majority of the century, we really looked at broader structural concerns. Starting in the 60s, a small group of academics at the Chicago School started saying that this approach to antitrust was inefficient, that it was causing business uncertainty, was keeping the economy back, and they started advocating a view that antitrust should really only be used to promote economic efficiency, which they ended up defining as consumer welfare. When this idea was first floated, it was pretty marginalized. Nobody really took it seriously, but it had a lot of funding behind it, and this group of intellectuals started gaining more credibility through the 70s. It was, you know, the most prominent leaders were Robert Bork or Richard Posner. With the election of Ronald Reagan, these ideas were then stamped into policy. So he appointed officials at the Justice Department, the Antitrust Division, and the Federal Trade Commission, that were, you know, part of the Chicago School view of viewing antitrust. And he also appointed throughout the federal judiciary, you know, individuals who, again, believed that the antitrust law should really only be focused on promoting this very narrow goal, which, at the end of the day, actually promotes consolidation, promotes monopolization. I mean, I think that's like the great perversity of our current antitrust laws, is instead of safeguarding us from concentrated wealth and power, they're now actually a tool of consolidation. Because if you can simply argue that, you know, a merger or business practice is enhancing efficiency, is enhancing consumer welfare, even if it's resulting in structural consolidation, even if it's resulting in diminishing competition, that now, you know, flies, that the antitrust agencies now accept that. And so I think, you know, it's interesting to realize that we really got to this stage without any input from Congress, without any input from the people. You know, it was basically just this revolution, this intellectual revolution that really bypassed the public conversation and the political economy in which we're now living, where we see extreme consolidation and concentration across the board. That is the direct result of this massive shift in how we interpret antitrust laws.
Okay, let's go to a phone call. Keith is in St. Paul. He called 651-227-6000, or maybe he called 1-800-242-2828. I do not know, but he called. Thanks for calling, Keith. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my comment, you asked for someone who is an entrepreneur and started a company using these, and I'm just going to agree with the moderator's point that Amazon and Google in particular have made you know, have opened up a new frontier online with their incredibly effective and cheap computing power. Amazon Web Services, which I don't think has been brought up yet, is what the internet runs on because they're just better than the competition. And there's no reason other than the fact that their software engineers put together a product that was superior to the competition. And quite honestly, you know, there are international competitors that I would be perfectly willing to switch to if they stopped being the best. So, you know, is tech different because you're just one click away from choosing a different service? Like, you know, if you remember, delete Uber, it was some bad press for people to start saying, oh, wait, okay, I'm going to switch to Lyft.
Thanks for calling, Keith. Alex, I think that what Keith is talking about is something that a lot of people don't know about. They just think of Google as search or their Gmail,
yeah.
Or they think of Amazon as the place where they, as like I do, they get their hooks or their outlets or their books or whatever they order. What is he talking about, the Amazon services?
Well, Amazon Web Services, so Amazon just hit a sort of benchmark. It's been profitable for 11 straight quarters. Before this happened, it was basically never profitable. And 100% of Amazon's profits come from Amazon Web Services or something very close to that. It's, you know, essentially a cloud computing program. And, you know, their biggest clients include the U.S. government, many very large corporations. And, you know, it's a very good service. And I think it's one that as we, you know, if we return to the conversation about healthcare, is one that I think that Amazon is probably modeling after. However, I think one of the concerns here is that, you know, Amazon has been profitable for 11 quarters, as I said, but it's a retail business loses money partly because of this fixation on this consumer welfare standard. And that, I think, is troubling from an economic perspective.
Troubling for who? For all of us? For the investors in Amazon?
Using,
who's making
well,
money
using
here?
Their core function as an electronic retailer, right,
mm-hmm.
to get consumer data and other things, which they then spin off and to get users, but they're losing money, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, no one is going to generally say that if your core function is to sell things that you should be losing money selling them. And yet that's exactly what Amazon's done for the last 20 years.
Lena, what do you think? Do you think there's ever going to be any movement to break up Amazon or Google? I mean, who would the lawsuit have to come from?
It could come from the state attorneys general who have antitrust authority. It could come from the Justice Department, from the Federal Trade Commission. Oftentimes it takes suits from private parties to basically, you know, get the engine going. Basically, oftentimes, you know, it'll be private suits that then lead to discovery that produce the information that can then create the basis for a much bigger suit brought by the government. That's what we saw with Netscape and, again, in the case against Microsoft. So I think, you know, we're definitely – I think we're past an inflection point. I think for many, many years, these Silicon Valley companies were viewed as unambiguously good for us as consumers, as you know, as citizens. They were just viewed to be, you know, kind of leading the march to progress. I think that view has changed in the last year or so. I think, you know, news about Russian meddling in the election through Facebook really helped change the conversation about whether these companies have acquired too much power and whether that power is being abused. And so I think we're hearing more of government officials potentially looking into antitrust issues.
Nancy called, and she is in Lakeville. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Say, I have a question for Lena, if she can confirm this. My concern is that with the antitrust and the ability for them, Amazon in particular, to squash competition, I've heard recently, and it happened maybe a couple of years ago, that Amazon is contracted not only with UPS, which is fine, that's a private company, it's also contracted for delivery of its packages with the United States Postal Service. And that's a government service that we are paying for, and Amazon, a huge behemoth, is taking up a portion of their service. Now, we all see the little people, the little mail carriers delivering packages on Sunday, but doggone it, I go 3 to 4 days without my personal mail. And I've heard this from other people throughout the country that they also see, I'll have a pileup on Friday of just a ton of personal mail. And we've been seeing this for several years, but I believe that this contract with the USPS happened. And how is that? How is that, you know, Amazon is getting an edge with their delivery that other businesses don't have?
Thank you so much, Nancy. I've got to clear my throat. Sorry. Lena, it is kind of strange that Amazon is, like, at the moment kind of bending the U.S. Postal Service to their will, or is it renewing the life of the Postal Service? Is it giving it new meaning?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think this is actually a question that resonates more generally with, you know, the question of government subsidies and the degree to which governments have been giving Amazon benefits that distort the playing field. I think, you know, in the case of the Postal Service, there have been studies. There was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago that was arguing that Amazon actually gets a big subsidy from the Postal Service. And that, you know, as the caller pointed out, that we are, in effect, all subsidizing Amazon's growing clout and capacities in the physical delivery space. But again, I think this is a broader question, you know, as we see Amazon kind of launch this, you know, sweepstakes contest for its second headquarters, and you see all these mayors bending backwards on putting billions and billions of dollars of subsidies on the table. I think it's worth asking, you know, in what ways will this further distort the playing field? And also, you know, is the public, will the public really be getting the bang for its buck? There was an EPI study that just came out last week that showed that where the jobs actually do not increase substantially after, you know, Amazon moves in, that its warehouse jobs, you know, either are being offset by the decimation in retail more generally, or the new jobs are not, you know, generally significant enough to really mark any notable increase in employment. So I think, you know, we really should be thinking more generally about the kind of subsidies that governments offer and whether they are worth it.
Jack called us from New Brighton. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Hi. Just fine. I have a couple of questions. One thing on the retail end, Amazon is actually, I would think, the opposite of a monopoly. If I go to buy something, I usually have an option of several other suppliers other than Amazon directly. And I can also find manufacturers and distributors, including books, used books, for instance, that I can't possibly have access to in the local retail market. And then the second, and if you've ever tried to deal with Walmart or Costco, the buyers there, you have to be able to fill thousands of shelves across the country in order to get in their supply chain. The second thing is we're talking about retail, but there's lots of other consolidations going on mm-hmm. that become monopolistic, especially like in healthcare. There's very few healthcare organizations in the Twin Cities than there were several years ago, and in general across consolidation banking, lots of industries have been monopolized, and mm-hmm. we're not even talking about those.
It's true. Thank you, Jack, for calling. Alex, first I want to have you respond to Jack and talk about the big box stores. We used to wring our hands about Walmart being a monopoly, and now Jack is saying, you know, Walmart doesn't give me what I want, and Amazon does. Is Amazon's time going to sunset too, just like the way that Walmart is kind of going through a little bit of a churn right now, or Sears Roebuck, or today, Bon-Ton Stores, a department store that had been around for 100 years, just filed for bankruptcy. Will Amazon's monopolistic behavior stick around for a while and then disappear? What do you think?
Well, I'll sort of pivot a little bit away from that and say that just because Amazon, Amazon's economic effects are unsettling, that doesn't mean that the economic effects of Walmart aren't as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the way of thinking about Amazon in these cases is that its ultimate goal and the way that it's oriented itself for the last 20 years, and I think this follows with its Amazon Health move as well, is that it wants to basically take a cut out of every transaction that's made online. In some cases, you see them moving, in the case of Amazon Books, to physical retail as well. Certainly in AWS is, I think, a part of this as well. So, you know, you can say, yes, it's possible to get other things. I mean, I use Amazon to buy lots of older books. I actually just bought a book about the breakup of AT&T that was not available anymore on Amazon. But I think that, you know, this is it's funny because when Amazon first came onto the scene, it complained all the time about how the publishing industry was just, you know, this unnecessary old-fashioned middleman, right? But what Amazon has created is arguably like the greatest middleman in, you know, maybe American economic history, because it's just setting itself up so it's always at the very least taking a dollar or two from all of these transactions. And I think that effect is very troubling.
Lena, one other thing that he had mentioned was, our caller mentioned, was Jack, was that we are only talking about Amazon and Google, and there have been, it's been a record couple years for mergers, and there have been a lot of other industries that are being monopolized. Are these platform corporations like Facebook, Google, Amazon, the top worry at the Open Markets Institute, or are there other things that we aren't even thinking of that you think are a bigger danger to our economy and to workers?
So open market studies consolidation and concentration more generally, even before, you know, the rise of the tech platforms, we were studying these issues. And these issues have preceded the tech platforms. You know, since the early 1980s, due to this change in how we do antitrust laws, we've seen merger wave after merger wave consolidate, you know, sector after sector. So, you know, four companies dominate the airline industry. You know, four companies have 80% of chicken industry in the United States. You know, three pharmacies control the sector. So, you know, this problem of concentration is really now a systemic and pervasive feature of our political economy. I think the issue with the tech platforms is they really underscore this problem and they make it worse. In part, you know, these tech companies are actually spurring further consolidation throughout the economy. So we heard the other week that CVS and Aetna are trying to merge, partly in response to, you know, suggestions that Amazon will be moving more aggressively into the healthcare space. As Alex mentioned, you know, Amazon's clout in the book sector has led to more mergers throughout the book publishing sector. But if you look at the kinds of news stories, you know, in the 80s and 90s, those were actually documenting the harms that were stemming from excessive consolidation within publishing. You know, Barnes & Noble and Borders were seen as kind of the death to the richness of the book sector. So I think these problems are ones that we've faced for a couple of decades now, but I think they're coming to a head with the tech platforms.
So what is the overall danger with these, with a monopoly, if these continue? Is it going to be that Jeff Bezos will own everything and then one day all the prices will quadruple? Or is it that jobs are disappearing and there won't be enough jobs? Or is it lack of wage growth? What is the big concern, Alex?
I mean, all of the above. I mean, I tend to be more of a skeptic to the argument that Amazon will one day, you know, flip a switch and everything will cost, you know, four times what it costs right now. But I think that the danger here is that, you know, these companies are taking over basic functions of human interaction from commerce to just the kinds of, you know, birthday greetings, things like that. And, you know, at the same time, they're also accumulating an enormous amount of data about who we are. They've shown themselves to be, you know, very susceptible to being taken over by pretty low rent, you know, hostile action aimed at, you know, bringing out our worst instincts as human beings. You know, but then there's also just the basic issue of what kind of America we want to live in, right? And, you know, your weekend was a lot like my weekend, where you just spend it, you know, interacting with one monopoly after another. You go to a Chase bank, and then you shop on Amazon, and you search on Google. And, you know, that, I think, has really detrimental effects.
Lena, what do you think the detrimental effects are? Is it economic? Is it societal fabric? What is your top concern?
I think all of those concerns are very real. I think it ultimately comes down to control. You know, do we want a single company to have such outsized control over our economy? And what does that mean for workers, for the other businesses that are trying to get to market? I think, you know, one of the interesting things about Amazon and some of these tech platforms more generally is that oftentimes there's a sense of inevitability that surrounds their rise. You know, these companies just produce superior technologies and were able to, in very innovative ways, bring those to market, and that's what's led to their dominance. I think to some degree, you know, it's undeniable that these companies had, you know, great ideas they were able to bring to market. But in other degrees, it's worth looking at how the legal backdrop has shifted. And partly Amazon has gone to where it's gone to through, you know, engaging in anti-competitive practices that a few decades ago would have been illegal. It was able to avoid paying taxes for the first several years it was in business. So I think we need to look, you know, generally against how we structure our marketplaces, what are the laws that are in place, and what are, you know, the ends that we're trying to promote.
Okay, Lena, it's a global economy. Is it going to be Europe that pushes this forward and then the United States will follow? Or will the United States, do you think that there's enough public interest in controlling these countries a little bit more that could rise up in the United States?
So far, we definitely have seen Europe take the lead and kind of, you know, investigating the anti-competitive aspects of these companies. The Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. had a, you know, multi-year investigation into Google that ended up wrapping that up without really doing anything. It kind of accepted voluntary concessions from Google. We later learned that the staff at the FTC had found that Google had violated antitrust laws on 3 counts and recommended bringing a suit. But that recommendation was not taken up by the head commissioners. In Europe, by contrast, we saw Europe issue a huge fine on Google last summer and more generally find that the company had abused its power by discriminating. So what they said was Google was using its control over search to privilege its shopping comparison website. And they said that, you know, is a violation of our antitrust laws. We recently heard that Germany is investigating Facebook for potentially anti-competitive use of user data. We've heard similar things about potential investigations in Amazon. So I definitely think that the, you know, European antitrust officials probably have a more realistic sense of how these companies are abusing their power. In the U.S. the other week, you know, an FTC official was quoted at a conference as saying, there's no problem here. You know, Amazon and Google don't have any market power. If you don't like Google, you can just use Bing. So I think you really see the difference in mindset between the two enforcement regimes.
Thank you both for joining us. Lena Khan is Director of Legal Policy at Open Markets Institute, and Alex Shepard, he's a staff writer at The New Republic. He's written about Amazon, including a great piece about visiting Amazon retail stores, and you should check out his writing. Thank you both for joining us. Bye-bye.